everyone, and welcome to minute 26 of season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Hans Gruber, a.k.a. DJ Valentine of the Simplistic Review. Welcome to the show, DJ.
Thanks for having me on the program, Rob. I am pleased and overjoyed to talk about the film, minutes of time, mostly starring me and some bartender who drinks wine coolers and sings on a harmonica. I think that's the name of the instrument. I played the recorder, actually. I'm actually a flutist also. I do many, many, many things, and I am not appreciated about it, but it's fine. It's all good.
Well, I'm grateful to have you for this week, because these are pure Hans minutes. So
of course,
it works perfectly.
What other podcasts would you want to do one about John McClane, Officer John McClane of the New York Police Department? Please come on.
All right, well, minute 26 begins with Hans trying to quiet down the crowd and ends with Ellis looking completely wasted.
It does. That's not the phrase I would have used for sure. That is accurate. That is
accurate. Why not? We're trying to be as accurate as possible here. You know, we're not beating around the bush. We're being as much straight shooters as we can. You know, especially since we haven't even gotten to the cowboy lines, but we're still doing it. So what we ended on Friday was the group of adversaries, or the villains. During this week, we'll figure out what they really are, but let's just call them villains for now. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the villains show up, and they get out of the elevator, and they start shooting, and they start taking people out of rooms, you know, and they almost catch John McClane. But he's able to quickly run away and get into the stairs without any shoes. But he still is able to do that. And then we get a shot back in the main room where everyone is still partying. And we see Hans trying to gather everyone together. All the other villains are trying to gather everyone together. Hans is standing. It looks like he's getting ready to make a speech. You know, it's his valedictorian speech.
It's valedictorian speech. I've got 5 A's, 4 B's. My GPA is a 3.9.
When you go out into the world, make
take
sure
all you can take. Give nothing back.
There you go. And I mean, I love how he's standing there. You have the other villains all standing around, half on guard, half slouching, you know, just enjoying what's going on. You know, and, you know, he's got like this Filofax in his hand, which is just really funny that he's carrying it around. It, like, it shows how highbrow he's meant to be, you know, by holding it up. And then he like opens it and starts looking inside. And I mean, first of all, he's very cool and collective here. You know, he's trying to calm everyone down. He picks up his hands, you know, and tries to calm people down in a very polite and orderly manner, I guess you can say.
Right. Like he's, I mean, I had watched this scene close to 1500 times, but when I was spoofing it for the sketch on our show, I really got to like really get into it, 'cause I had to like rewrite it a little bit. And I think this opening bit with him encompasses Hans Gruber completely. He likes to play with his own perception a lot. He wants people to see him as this educated, charming guy, but he wants them also to see him as scary. It's clear here that he has, like, he's done his homework. He perfectly pronounces Takagi's whole name. He reads his bona fides, but then he, like, stalks through the crowd like a lion. Like, right. He's, like, walking through prey. And he's so and then he'll flip it again where he's, like, we're going to get to that later where he'll,
right. I think this whole week, I think you're right. I think this entire week he's doing that. Right. You know, every single scene that we see him here, we're going to later on see him in the elevator, we're going to see him in the boardroom, you know, all of these places, he's doing exactly what you said. And that's this. These are actually five, in my opinion, five very integral minutes in this movie, because they establish Hans Gruber as one of the best villains in any movie ever.
Right.
You know, most movies will just, you know, like even fun movies like Under Siege, which has Tommy Lee Jones, you know, as the bad guy, you know, they gloss over the character a little too much. Mm. You know, he's fun to watch and stuff like that.
He's not subtle, Tommy Lee. Tommy Lee is right. Full bore. Him, I mean, when he's overpowering Gary Busey, you know, he's full bore. Where
right.
Hans is subtle. He's looking for somebody on his level throughout this movie, in mind situation.
Right. He's looking for someone on the same intellectual level as him, which right. he doesn't find.
No, I mean he thinks there's moments in the movie where he thinks he finds, and I don't want to bring it back to comic book stuff, but there's a scene in Captain
America. Bring it back. The first... You weren't there.
Sorry.
No, I'm saying bring it back. You weren't there yet.
My history is that I'm a comic book geek, but yeah, there's a scene in Captain America: The First Avenger near the end where Red Skull has captured Captain America, and they at the time had both taken this super soldier serum that's made them super strong, and like mm-hmm. Red Skull thought he was given it because he's this holier than thou intellect, perfect person. And he wants to know why this normal person, it infuriates him that this normal person like Steve Rogers also got the thing that he thought it was bestowed by gods and destiny. And that's kind of like Hans throughout this movie, where he's like, I'm looking for my intellectual equal, and it's this flatfoot cop from New York City. No, there's no way. It should be somebody like Takagi. It should be somebody like crap Ellis or Holly Gennaro. It should be somebody like that. But for some reason, it's this dude that doesn't. He's just a guy. I think that pisses Hans off the most throughout this film.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. But I love the cat and mouse between the two of them because of that. Because they're not on the same intellectual level, but they're still, each of them are since they're both trying to outsmart the other one, but in different ways.
I think they are on the same intellectual level. I mean, well, it's almost like his street smarts are so high, it negates Hans's intellect. So they're smart on two different levels, and it kind of evens them out, which is every time I watch it, it's like, but I can tell Hans cannot accept. He wanted a different type of challenge. Well, I didn't say he didn't want a challenge; he just wanted the 30%. But he kind of didn't. He kind of thought he was going to get some kind of resistance, and he thought he figured out all the resistance he would get would be these businessmen or feds or government types or the media. It wouldn't be. Some security.
Some poison. Poison pill.
Some poison pill. Yeah, it wouldn't be that. That's what I dig about it, because he likes playing the game, but he thinks he should have won five moves ago. But for some reason, this chess savant is winning with some without even like he's just moving pieces around where he's studied chess for years.
Right.
And this guy keeps hanging with him.
Exactly. He's like, what the hell is Bobby Fischer doing here?
You know? Yeah, well, get out of here, Bobby Fischer. I'm Russian. Come on.
Seriously. So do you want to actually do the dialogue right now for what Han says here?
Okay, I can do it right here. Ladies and gentlemen. And then this is the best part. He gets really loud, and then he gets really quiet. He goes,
yes. Well, he's trying to get everyone's attention, and then
right, you know, their attention.
That's what you do. You scream, so get polite. The attention, and then you do it nice and slowly and calmly.
Right. He's a dude at the Nakatomi Corporation's legacy of greed around the globe. They're about to be taught to rest, and then the real use of power. You will be witnesses, and he gets real quiet, and he just closes the book like, "Nada."
I don't need the book anymore. Like, what was he reading from the book?
I think that might have been his notes. I really want to know, because he speaks multiple languages, multiple accents. I don't think it was his speech. I think it was notes on Takagi, if I had to guess, because then he goes right into, which he has memorized. He's probably been reading up on Takagi this whole time. Where is Mr. Takagi? And then he just lays it out, which is a flex, as we call it in the hood. Just that I know everything about this guy. I am not to be messaged. I know his whole Joseph Yoshinobu Takagi, born Kyoto, 1930. He just lays out everything. And then
Holly goes, "Don't move." She grabs him,
which I love. This is one of the moments of this movie. When I saw this movie when I was 10, and I followed on pretty well, but that was one of the moments that helped me confuse me a little bit on when I was 10. I thought Holly left John and married Takagi because I was 10 years old. I didn't realize it, and this is one of the moments where she was so protective of him. Right. I thought that they, again, once I wore out to the game, I was like, oh yeah, she's just a very, that she really likes her boss or whatever. But that was one of the moments where she said, don't move. And she
I love the way that her fingers curl around his arm.
His she's arm, like, right, right.
It's
right,
like
right.
One finger at a time. It's like in a fanning right. motion type of thing. Yeah.
Right. Goes, the best move. Part of this, the best part of this speech is at the very end.
Well, which won't be today. We're today.
But yeah, he pretty much goes, family immigrated to San Pedro, California, 1939. Interned at Manzanar, 1942-43. Scholarship student, University of California.
And then he gets cut off. No, that's it. That's where he gets cut off. We don't go beyond that. So, I mean, first of all, it's a great speech. There's no question about it. Obviously, this is just the beginning of the speech anyway. But
and it's backstory. You're getting backstory out.
We get so much backstory about Takagi at this point. We, you know, first of all, the first thing we find out is that he is 51 years old.
Right.
You know, and well, actually, the first thing we find out about is the fact that it's the Nakatomi Corporation. They have a legacy of greed around the globe. So, you know, we never really find out.
That could be an opinion, though. That could be Hans's perception of the company. Yeah. I got the thing I got out of it, because when we first see you had talked about it earlier on previous shows, that when you first see Takagi, he's so likable and down to earth, and he's probably dealt with crap his entire life, and it you see his upbringing, as Hans says, he lived in San Pedro, California. He's almost as American as anybody. He's right. Probably been bullied, and he pulled himself. I think the first line he says to John is something about Pearl Harbor. He jokes about it.
Yes, probably he says, "Well, Pearl Harbor didn't work out, so we decided to get you a tape deck."
Right. So it's like
is so prophetic when you think about it nowadays. You know, I mean, thirty-four years later, you know, the Japanese really did get everybody with all the technology.
Exactly.
Yeah,
but yeah, I just got that from his dad and his backstory, is that he's probably now I know he's a good guy. He's a good dude.
Yes.
And despite what Hans is saying about his corporation, which again we don't know much. I don't know if they get into it as much in the novel.
No, because the novel has its completely different characters. Because Texas. It's a Texas oil
man or something, right?
Company. Yeah. So we're not even going to go in there this week, because none of that is really relevant here. But
right. But yeah, I just like how, I mean, I always appreciate when a movie puts in, I mean, because that's the big hurdle, is when you're like, I got to put in an exposition when you're writing something. And if you do it in a natural way that actually, like, you're in this scene, usually somebody starts talking about backstory, you kind of zone out a little bit. But here, because of Rickman's performance, how they stage it, the cat and mouse, the tension of the scene or whatever, you're getting all this backstory, and it's good. It helps the character, and it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie because of what's going on.
Which is why it was kismet that you got this week. You know?
Yes, very, very much.
Right. So, I mean, some of the things that he mentions here, I want to just quickly go into. Okay, so what is greed?
What is greed? Greed. Yeah.
Greed is good.
For lack of besides a word, greed, it's good. Yes. Are we talking about Wall Street now? Hey, look, Michael Douglas, come on here. Greed. I think it's more, I don't want to say it's like a Disney thing. I think in terms of you are dominating the market to the point where whatever market that is, other companies can't even compete with you, to the point where they have to fold up because of the, your large success, you're not even making it an even playing field with other people. You have completely taken over. That's what I kind of see the Nakatomi Corporation as, is they're just the Disney of, you know, how Disney's literally taking over the movie industry. They bought Fox, you know, they're buying all this other stuff. That's kind of how I saw Nakatomi in terms of
Lucasfilm
Corporation of industry kind of thing. Somewhat.
Yeah, right. So basically the definition of greed is an uncontrolled longing for increase in the acquisition or use of material gain, be it food, money, land, animate or inanimate possessions, social value, status, power, right? It's been identified as undesirable throughout known human history because it creates behavior conflict between personal and social goals, right? The initial motivation or the purpose of greed and actions associated with it may be the promotion of personal or family survival. It may be the same, the intent to deny or obstruct competitors from potential means for basic survival and comfort or future opportunities. Therefore, being insidious or tyrannical and having a negative connotation. Alternatively, the purpose can be defense or counteractive response to such obstructions being threatened by others. But regardless of purpose, greed intends to create an inequity of access or distribution to community wealth, which fits in exactly what you were saying. I mean, apparently what they're trying to tell us here is that the Nakatomi Corporation, at least in Hans Gruber's eyes, is a company that is, you know, doing things in order to make itself better, but at the same time, it's bringing other people or companies or, you know, bringing other people down. Mm-hmm. You know, for their own survival.
He selected Nakatomi for. I mean, he could have attacked anyone.
Yes.
Or stolen anyone. And I think he tried to find.
But we find out later this week why he chose Nakatomi. There's a reason. We'll get there. Right. We'll get there, I think, on Friday. We'll talk about that. You know, just to keep people around, you know, who are interested in finding out what it is that's going to happen on Friday. And the one last thing I want to say about greed is there actually are researchers that have suggested that there is a genetic basis for greed. And that when going through the genome, they found that there is a gene called the ruthlessness gene.
Really?
And I'm being serious. Yeah. And apparently there's a defect in that particular gene, which helps make people more selfish.
Well,
so next time you want to go get your genome checked, you know, check to see what's going on with your AVPR1A.
Where do I go to get my genome checked?
I don't know. At your local genome
store. I go to CVS and they got a genome checker right there next to the blood pressure machine.
There you go. Exactly. And then, you know, he continues with his little diatribe. Now he mentions the name Takagi, right? Which we all know that this is Joseph Takagi.
Joseph Yoshinobu Takagi, yeah.
Right. So my first question that I wanted to look up was, is Yoshinobu, is that like the Japanese version of Joseph? Mm. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to figure out what it is. The only explanation I could find is that Yoshinobu is a masculine Japanese given name. Okay. That's all I could find. It's not like, okay, you know, it's not like you would say, oh, it's another, you know, if you Anglicanize it, it comes out that it's Joseph, which would make a lot of sense. You know, it's like where you have a lot of people that you know, that their names are, you know, that we have Italians that are like that, you know.
Right.
And stuff like that. So, and then I looked up what Takagi means. Okay. You have any clue what Takagi means in English?
Man, no. I have no idea.
It means tall tree.
Tall tree?
Tall tree.
Odd.
You know, a tree that is tall, not poultry.
It's like poultry. What are you trying to say here? Poultry, a tree that is tall, huh? I guess because he's kind of, I can see the symbolism kind of. I'm not sure if D'Souza just grabbing names or he actually put any thought into etymology or whatnot. Like, but you know, I can see how you can make a thing about, you know, he's the the big tree of the company, and they, you know, he keeps it, people close. You can do that. Or Steven D'Souza could have been like, you know what sounds really cool? Takagi.
Right. He could have. Exactly. That's probably what it was. Mm. You know, they probably heard it somewhere. I mean, according to Wikipedia, it had lists 24 people, famous people, you know, with the name Takagi. So I don't know if any of them are related to what, you know, D'Souza used in order to, you know, to choose the name here. You know, there's one that's an American martial arts instructor named John Mamoru Takagi. I don't know. No clue. But I just thought it was pretty funny. And then fictional characters, I said there are five. Okay. There's obviously Joe Takagi, the one here. And then the other four are all from mangas.
Okay.
Yeah, which
I guess, came out in before 88 or after 88?
I believe they all came out afterwards. Yeah, but I'm not a big manga fan, so I couldn't tell you. I mean, I can tell you the names of them. If you know manga, you might know. Okay, you know, there's Teasing Master Takagi-san.
Nope.
Okay. Tomie.
Tomie?
Tomie, T-O-M-I-E.
T-O-M-I-E. I think I might have heard of that before.
Okay. Bakuman.
Bakuman I've heard before.
Okay. And High School of the Dead.
That I've heard before. I'm not a huge manga fan, but I have a friend who definitely is, and I have heard him rumble those names a couple times.
Okay, but you've never heard him say Takagi. So now you got to go ask him if you've heard of Takagi.
I'm say, hey, was your manga? I almost said comic book. Was your manga inspired by my favorite movie of all time? Was that what's going on here? And he's probably like, no,
for sure not. Right, and then it mentions here that he immigrated to San Pedro, California, in 1939 when he was two. Mm-hmm. Okay, so San Pedro.
That there's another backstory thing. So 1939, what's going on at that point? Isn't that he's a child, so he's probably what, two?
He's World not War probably II two. Is, he's two. He's two. He's World two, War so II is World 2 years War, away.
2 years away, so he's probably going to be in like middle school after the whole World War II things happened. So you know they were probably very in school, very hard on him in public school. Probably. If he even went to public school. So, I mean, that's what got him that thick skin and that resilience to be, you know, the CEO of a company pretty much.
Could be. That's very possible. So San Pedro is actually a neighborhood in the city of Los Angeles. It used to actually be its own city, but then it consolidated with L.A. in 1909. Hmm. Okay. It used to be an area that was dominated by the fishing industry, and then it became a working class community. And so what's really cool about this is the fact that, you know, just knowing that information says so much about his, you know, he grew up in a fishing industry.
Right.
You know, he's in a I guess lower to middle class area where he's growing up, or where he was in, you know, 1939. So then I was looking up to see if there are any interesting people that are from the area of San Pedro. Okay. So first of all, there's a guy, I'm sure you've never heard of him. His name is Larry Walters.
Oh, that's my friend, Larry Walters. I know Larry. No, I'm joking. I've never heard of Larry Walters.
Okay. He's someone who piloted a lawn chair with 45 helium-filled weather balloons from his house in St. Petersburg.
Joseph Takagi's neighbor, Larry Walters, crazy person with a lawn chair and balloons.
Yeah. Well, what's really interesting is that, I mean, this is a guy who was born in 1949. And he died in 1993. So my biggest question is did he die from flying?
We'll never know.
Yeah. Right. Well, he made a 45-minute flight in a homemade airship made of an ordinary patio chair and 45 helium balloons on July 2nd, 1982.
So you're telling me that Pixar stole from this guy's life and made it a house instead of a lawn chair?
Apparently. And,
okay. All right.
Yeah, and actually – on Wikipedia, they have a picture that looks like a picture from Up. That's really cool. Yeah.
A lot of people from Pixar went to school in California, so they might have heard that story, the local story.
That's very possible. And he actually during landing his aircraft, they call it an aircraft, I like that, you know, became entangled in power lines, but he
Oh,
was able to.
you're asking me if he's alive? That had to
No,
have killed him.
no, it didn't. It didn't. It didn't. It says the flight attracted worldwide media attention and inspired a movie and imitators. There you go.
What is the movie? What is the movie?
What do you think? I'm assuming it's, you know, we're talking about,
What's the synonym
here.
for
They have a
of?
whole list here of all the imitators of who did it. Wow. There are tons of them. That's just amazing. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's 11 people who copied him. Okay. There's a guy in Massachusetts who made a flight of 9,000 feet with 57 helium balloons and descended by parachute. He was fined $4,000 for violating FAA
And they
regulations.
find him. They find him. After you almost died, here's a fine.
There are two guys who in 2001 made it into the Guinness Book of World Records when they were when they flew 400 helium balloons in order to in New Mexico. They made it to the height of 18,300 feet. And they say that Larry Walters only reached 16,000 feet. So,
This
but
isn't
since he
bad.
didn't have a proper altimeter, so
That's actually stunning.
they couldn't measure exactly how high he went. Then someone in Japan did it with 23 helium balloons. He was found 800 kilometers offshore in the Pacific Ocean.
God.
And
Oh my God.
oh wow, that he was spotted offshore, and then he was never seen again.
Oh
So
my
yeah,
God.
that's uh,
Yeah, shark got that guy.
maybe there's a 47-year-old American gas station owner in 2007 that flew 240 miles in his lawn chair, landing in a field about 3.5 miles northwest of Oregon. You know, he okay of Powder, Oregon. He was in Bend, Oregon.
I
Wow,
mean,
he had a couch.
the way gas prices are going now, I mean, helium is cheaper than petrol. You might as well get a lawn chair, put some helium balloons on there. If you can get that far, you can get it working back.
Right,
It's even
and
more
then
cost effective.
this guy actually did it again
Of
a
course,
few years
see?
later,
Come
and
here.
in order because he wanted to make it to the to Idaho. He wanted to have the record of going interstate.
Who wants to go to Idaho?
These are crazy people. In 2008, there was a Brazilian Roman Catholic priest, Adelaire Antonio de Carli, who suspended 600 helium-filled party balloons and reached the altitude of 5,300 meters and then landed safely in Argentina. Wow, we went from Brazil to Argentina.
Jesus Christ. I mean, guys, that is not a short distance. That is a
Wait, wait, wait,
long
wait.
time.
This is even better because this guy actually won the Darwin Award that year. Do you know what the Darwin Award is?
The person that does the stupidest thing,
And
essentially.
gets killed and gets
Okay.
killed doing it. So apparently he didn't on his second flight, which was a few months later, he hadn't checked the weather forecast and he got caught in a storm.
Oh,
He had a
no.
GPS but didn't know how to operate it. And
Oh,
they last
no.
heard from him 8 hours after liftoff, approaching the water after flying off the coast, unable to give his position before crashing into the Atlantic Ocean. The lower half of his body was found by the Brazilian Navy near an offshore oil platform 3 months later.
The lower half? Was he
Yeah.
chomped in half? What
I
happened?
don't know. That's what it says.
Darth Mauled him? Oh my God.
Well, Darth Maul came back, so you
That's
never
true.
know.
That's, maybe he's out somewhere. He's just keeping alive by anger.
This is just unbelievable. The people, the things that these people have done, you know. All
Wow.
right, well, I'm not going to go
I
through the
thought I did
rest
some
of
crazy
them.
stuff when I was a kid, but jeez.
Yeah, and so up was it partially inspired by all of these. Wow, and we're just talking about Larry Walters here, but
Just Larry. Good
Larry,
old Larry Walters.
how did he die? He died. He killed himself. There you go.
No, oh, chill.
When he was 44,
Got dark
he,
real fast.
yeah. Yeah. On August 6, 1993, at the age of 44, he died by suicide after shooting himself in the heart. He went to like some
Suicide.
secluded forest and did that. Oh, come on. He all because you know, he didn't get his Guinness Book of World Record fame with that.
You get money? I mean, is it that much
I don't
worth it?
know.
Ay,
He was
yeah,
a
all right.
letterman. They had him on Letterman after this happened.
Oh, man.
Unbelievable.
I bet you Letterman felt guilty about that.
Yeah, apparently. All right, so we'll continue with other people from San Pedro. we'll do them quickly. So you have D.L. Hewley. Do you know who that is?
Comedian.
Yes.
Comedian, yes.
So he went to San Pedro High School. Right. Then we have Patrick Muldoon, who is an actor from Days of Our Lives, Melrose Place, and he was in Starship Troopers.
Right, I think I know.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And the most famous actor is Mike Lookingland. Do you know who that is?
Mike Lookingland. Tell me a movie he's in. Maybe I'll.
No, just if I tell you the TV show he's in, you'll for sure know what it is.
Mike Lookingland?
Yes.
That does not sound familiar.
He was on a TV show from 1969 to 1974.
The Munsters? I have no idea.
No, that was earlier. That was earlier. He was Bobby Brady on the Brady Bunch.
Oh, see, I would have never known that. I was not a Brady Bunch fan.
Oh, okay. I was. So not when it originally aired. The final episode of the Brady Bunch aired the day I was born. So I didn't get to see any of those in first run. Then some other famous people, Louis L'Amour.
Louis L'Amour. That sounds like
he's a Western fiction writer.
Okay. I was thinking something to do with perfume, but like that makes more sense.
Yeah. And then when you're talking about different people in the movie industry, so Robert Town.
Oh, wow.
Is from there.
Okay.
Who was a writer, award
winner. Chinatown.
Four-time Oscar winner. You know,
yeah, I wrote Mission Impossible 2.
Mission Impossible and Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Chinatown.
And Chinatown. And The Firm.
He just featured on the TV show, there's a recreation, but he's on The Offer, the Godfather miniseries. Yeah, there was a scene where a character was playing Robert Town, speaking to Miles Teller. Like, oh, hey, Robert Town, Chinatown.
Oh, wow. Okay. Then you also have Tony Scott.
Oh, wow. Okay. That makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense.
Tony Scott loves film in L.A., so.
But not only was that, he committed suicide there.
Yeah, he did. Jumped off a bridge, yeah.
He jumped off the Vincent Thomas Bridge in the St. Pedro Port District. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, in retrospect, Top Gun is like taking over the box office, so kind of like in his memory, so.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Right. And then the final thing I wanted to talk about on this particular minute was Manzanar.
Okay.
Are you familiar with Manzanar?
I am not. I always hear him say it. I'm like, what in the hell is Manzanar? I never knew what that was.
Okay, so Manzanar was one of 10 American concentration camps.
Oh, wow.
Okay, which they put 120,000 Japanese Americans in during World War II between March of 1942 and November 1945. It's located at the foot of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. And it's about 230 miles north of L.A. Okay, the word Manzanar actually means apple orchard in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And it is the best preserved of the 10 former campsites because after the war, they pretty much destroyed most of the campsites because they were pretty embarrassed for having done something like this.
Well, that goes right to his backstory again, where Takagi is strong-willed. If you're in a concentration camp, and you grew up during World War II, and you're Japanese in America, your skin is pretty tough, I'd say.
That's right. That's very true. So there are three movies that take place in or that feature Manzanar. Mm-hmm. What, can you think of any of them?
Oh, no, I cannot.
Okay. So one of them is called Come See the Paradise with Dennis Quaid.
All right.
Which I like that. It's a great movie. It's about an American who falls in love with a Japanese girl, and then he has to join the army, and then she and her family get sent to Manzanar, and he's trying to get back to them and stuff like that. I really enjoyed that movie. Then you have a movie Snow Falling on Cedars.
I've heard of Snow, yes.
Which is about a family or a community of Japanese Americans from the state of Washington who are incarcerated there, and it goes through what happened to them while they were there. Is a movie that came out in 1999. Right. And then the final movie is one that I'm sure you've heard of, The Karate Kid.
Oh, shit. Yeah. The perfect. Pat Morita.
Mr. Miyagi, okay, tells Daniel about the fact that his wife and son both died in Manzanar.
Dang.
Yes. And what's even more interesting is that Pat Morita himself was interned there for 2 years when he was a little kid with his parents.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
So you know what? Maybe Mr. Miyagi and Joe Takagi know each other.
Oh, look at that's a that's a script right there. That's a script right there. You could write a script about that.
Go ahead. I give you the rights to that.
Takagi, but from what you're reading, his backstory is some hard level stuff.
Yes.
I mean, that is a movie right there. You can do.
Yeah, but unfortunately, both Pat Morita and James Shigeta. Right. Unfortunately, both of them have passed away, so it won't be as good if you make a. I mean, obviously, you couldn't use either of them.
A prequel series. You can get a cast too.
Yeah, but you want a prequel series, but you want to still have the flashbacks, because otherwise, you know, who's Takagi and who's Mr. Miyagi? You know,
You're trying to do a Godfather 2 situation, but you can just go full prequel. You can't they did Ip Man that way. You can do that.
Right.
Got to get a good writer. Get Robert Towne.
There you go. Now, the last line of this minute is great, that he mentions that he is a scholarship student at the University of California, which, again, tells us so much about his background that, you know, his family didn't have money. He needed to go to college on scholarship.
Right.
Which says a lot about him also.
He's a bad man. He's a good man, but I mean, he's pulled literally the American dream, essentially. Is Joseph Takagi.
Yeah, pretty much. All right, so you have anything else for this minute before we get into the script?
No, we're good. I'm good.
Okay, so the script here, there are a few discrepancies, not that many, but first of all, the language is a little different, because what he says, what Han says is, ladies and gentlemen, due to the Nakatomi Corporation's legacy of greed around the globe, it is about to be taught a lesson on real power. You will be witnesses. If our demands are not met, however, you may become participants instead.
Oh, that's a good line.
It's a little more vicious, by the way, right, that he says it. And then it says he, you know, checks his notes and says, now where is Takagi? Where is the man who used to be in charge here? And then it says Takagi is shoved forward. He's worried, but far from cowed. So, and they don't have the bio at all.
Okay.
So, I mean, I'm assuming that Alan Rickman didn't decide to ad-lib the whole idea of the, you know, the bio.
This might have been a McTiernan thing where he's like, I want him to go, that's the staging of it. I want him to kind of like weave in and out of the crowd. So right. we need him to do something. We don't want it in silence. We'll just make up a backstory for him to just spout off probably.
Yeah. Completely. Now, I think that if he did all this research, he would have a picture of Takagi.
Mm.
You know, I mean, that is true.
It is 88.
They didn't have Google. I know that. But still, you know, you'd think that in his file of facts, he would have a picture of him also. You know,
They do add a couple Japanese actors in the scene, I guess, just to compensate for that. But you're right. They should have had a picture of him.
You know, it's like, where's Takagi's baseball card?
Yeah. Where's the 1979 Takagi? I've been looking for it my entire life.
Exactly. So yeah, they do a great job with that, of making the scene come alive. Every Monday, we have a segment called Die Hard on a Monday, where my guests will give their top five Die Hard doppelganger movies. So DJ, what have you got for us? Start with number five and work your way up.
All right. Five was really hard for me, mainly because in terms of quality, the fifth ones are kind of the ones that are trying to buy into this list, kind of all mixed together in terms of quality. But I'm going to go Air Force One, because it does have Gary Oldman and Harrison Ford going head to head, which is probably the best actor protagonist antagonist coupling of all of these. So I'm going to go Air Force One, number five.
Okay.
Number four is an unsung movie. I remember watching this movie in the theater and I freaking loved it. I'm going Toy Soldiers.
Great movie.
Yeah. I remember watching this, and just the fact that I realize at this point, this is just Die Hard in a school. Like, this is, and it's Samwise Gamgee, it's John McClane. But I got a real soft spot for this film. It's insane as a concept, but I really dig it. On the simple fact that we've been toying around doing a movie commentary for this movie for a while, but we rarely ever do a commentary on a movie that we really like. And it's because of this movie we really like it. It's just been sitting there. We haven't done it. But yeah, Toy Soldier's good. You got Luke Gossett Jr. I mentioned...
you got Will Wheaton. Will Wheaton plays...
Will Wheaton
plays,
is in here for a little bit.
But,
yeah.
But he's a little... he's miscast as a mafia son. You know, yeah.
As a mafioso son, yes.
Yeah, with that earring. The way that they, you know, just to make him, you know, to break out of that Wesley Crusher...
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's kind of like a School Ties meets Die Hard kind of movie. But I dig it. I dig it. Yeah. Number three, we mentioned it earlier. I'm going Under Siege. Great cast. As capable as Casey Ryback is, he's not as charismatic a lead for me. Maybe because of Steven Seagal. Probably because of Steven Seagal.
Well, it's my favorite Steven Seagal role. I hate most of them.
My favorite Steven Seagal. That's a good question. Is it my favorite Steven Seagal role? Role, yes. Movie, I think I lean hard to Kill, but I think it's everything else around it, not him.
Okay.
But yeah, yes.
I think you're leaning towards Kelly LeBrock there with Hard to Kill.
That, so, and I love revenge movies, and that's pretty much just a straight up revenge movie, and William Sadler is the bad guy. So yeah, I think Casey Ryback as a role, yes, this is probably the most likable Steven Seagal has been in any movie, but he's still not likable at all. So,
right, and it was the first time that they got him to chop up that stupid ponytail.
Oh, so. Jesus, yeah, stupid. Anyway, yeah. Number two, I talked about this with I think Jay and I talked about it with Jay, and we talked for hours. It was Cliffhanger. Number two,
of all
the Die Hard clones, I think this has the most enjoyable villain that's not Die Hard.
Yeah, okay.
John Lithgow just chews the living crap out of the scenery in this movie. Yeah. He is the entire – he's worth the ticket. The price of admission is John Lithgow. Just kill a man, he's like, you're a murderer. Kill a million, you're a conqueror. Go figure. He's so freaking fantastic. And you got, Stallone with no shirt on, climbing a mountain, which is ridiculous. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
And number one, of course. I think in terms of quality wise, and the fact that the cinematographer of Die Hard directed this movie, and there's a Die Hard Easter egg in it, I'm going with Speed. So, yeah, I don't know if you've talked about it, the terrorists in Die Hard or the antagonists in Die Hard arrive in a truck that says Atlantic Courier, and in Speed, when the bus finally blows up, it drives into a plane that says Pacific Courier or something to that effect. I think it's the same fictional corporation or whatever. I think Atlantic Courier is in Die Hard with a Vengeance. Pacific Courier is the same truck that's in Die Hard and in this. So yes, I'm going Speed number one.
All right, excellent, great. All right, so you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you, DJ?
I'm on Twitter. I'm under at trying to be DJV. The show's handle is at simply tweeters. Simply tweeting. It's linked to me. They change the name all the time. If you want to find our show, the Simplistic Reviews podcast, just search Simplistic Reviews, simplistic.reviews, Simplistic Reviews on Google. We're on YouTube. We're on Stitcher. We're on TuneIn. We're on Spotify. We're everywhere. So if you want to hear a bunch of silliness, go check us out.
All right. Excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcast you might be using to listen to this show. You can find me very simply just by doing a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on my website. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on Facebook. Till tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.